the National Archives podcast series, From Stevenson to Suburbia, the socio-economic impact of the coming of the railways to the Chilterns, presented by Rudy Newman as part of the Railways Change Lives conference.
Railways change lives. In their early days, people certainly thought this, be it beneficial for human achievement or actively harmful, as argued by stagecoach proprietors. Railways transformed the landscape and appeared at a time of great social, cultural and economic change. But they soon became viewed as commonplace and were quickly overlooked. When starting to be properly studied by academics in the 1960s, opinions polarised drastically. Were railways a central component to development, a locomotive, so to speak? Or was it simply a coincidence in the timing? There has always been a danger of over or under exaggerating their significance. Current trends follow a newer idea that while railways may very well have played a role in most areas of life, it may have been less forthright than previously thought, acting more as an intermediate facilitator to change than a direct cause. Today, the historical question on the railways is less, did railways change lives? And more, how much did railways change lives? Of the many studies completed, the majority have concentrated on urban settlements and regions. It's no surprise that burgeoning heavy industry benefited from the advantages of the new transport, and by the same token fostered railway development. But what about rural regions? Some research has been undertaken, but by comparison it is fragmented and very incomplete. My research centres on the counties of Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire, from the opening of the London and Birmingham Railway in 1838 up to 1900. But why choose these counties? Well, the region has two main interesting features. Firstly, it was a gateway to London. To have a London terminus from the north, it simply had to be traversed. Indeed, three of the later Big Four company main lines and the Metropolitan Railway passed through it. Secondly, because of both this, but even today it remains very rural, there was a huge amount of diversity to analyse. Railway impacts on pure agriculture and also on previously established small industry. To give an extreme comparison of the diversity to be found, Bedfordshire ranged from the small village of Potton, having small-scale excavation of dinosaur coprolite for fertiliser, all the way up to W.H. Allen & Son of Bedford Town manufacturing the dynamo sets for the Titanic. Both of these products were transported by rail. The study is particularly concentrated on three main aspects: population, occupation and land use, seeing how changes in these correlate to railway development. The National Archives and National Railway Museum, while holding very different types of sources, have been absolutely essential. But first, some background railway history. The London and Birmingham Railway, designed by Robert Stephenson, was the world's first trunk railway line, built for terminus-to-terminus trade between the two metropolises. Opened in September 1838, it was the first railway in this region. A great success, later becoming part of the London and North Western Railway, it was soon joined by other pioneering lines, notably for this region, the Paddington to Bristol Great Western Railway of 1841 through South Buckinghamshire, the 1842 Liverpool Street to Norwich Northern and Eastern Railway in South Hertfordshire, which became part of the Great Eastern Railway in 1865, and the 1850 York to King's Cross Great Northern Railway through Eastern Bedfordshire and Central Hertfordshire. In addition, branch lines were constructed, such as the Elsbury and Cheddington Railway in 1839, the first ever branch line, and the 1848 London Norwestern Leighton Dunstable branch. Of particular reference are the Bletchley-Bedford, Bletchley-Banbury and Bletchley-Oxford lines, slowly expanding into a scarce example of a west-to-east rather than north-to-south main line. By 1851, some eight companies had built 13 railways in this area. Now, as we know, Britain had three great railway manias, 1839-40, 1845-7 and 1865-6, and this lattermost had the greatest effect on the region. By 1901, 26 companies were operating 33 interconnected lines. The most important were the 1857 Leicester to Hitchin and 1868 Bedford to St Pancras extensions of the Midland Railway, running through Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire. The Maidenhead to Verney Junction line through Buckinghamshire, built in sections by the Wickham Railway and later the Great Western, between 1854 and 1868. The Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire extensions of the Metropolitan Railway, from 1887 to 1892. And the 1899 Annesley to Marylebone Great Central Railway extension through Buckinghamshire, joint operating with the Metropolitan south of Quainton Road. Branch lines were even more prolific, such as the Hatfield, Luton and Dunstable Railway, ultimately completed in 1860, taken over by the Great Northern in 1861. The 1863 Ware Haddam and Buntingford Railway, taken over by the Great Eastern in 1869. And the so-named Hemel Hempstead and London and North Western Railway of 1877, which strangely was operated by the Midland Railway, who purchased it in 1886. Railway development obviously rocketed, and records at the National Railway Museum paint a picture not only of the spread of these lines through maps, guides and timetables, but their physical construction, the famous watercolours by J.C. Bourne being but one example. As for the managerial side, the myriad of companies, bills and takeovers, the National Archives holds records, including minutes and shareholders' reports for many railways large and small, detailing routes and finances, inspections, land purchases, and even small details such as individual contractors. Together, the business and operation sides of railway life are reunited. Having noted the rising historical trend for the facilitator view of railways, that they enabled other factors to cause change, rather than necessarily always being pivotal in themselves, the physical development of the railways in this region supports another new theory. Faulting indecisive government for failing to limit its effects, it's been argued that increasing competition between railway companies and their desire to protect their territories was a primary factor in the cause of the manias, with ever more lines like these built nationwide through blatant competition, but servicing essentially the same number of potential passengers and businesses, a greater variety of choice in which railway to use arose. Monopolies decreased, forcing fares down to retain revenue. Consequently, more could afford to travel, particularly considering the 1844 Cheap Trains Act. And railway companies thus began switching from the earlier business practice of terminus-to-terminus trade to providing a superior service, thus attracting clientele, along the whole length of their lines. The records of the National Archives give an insight into the creation and takeover of smaller companies as part of this competitive business strategy. The records of the Hatfield and St Albans Railway show the small company was actively supported from the outset by the Great Northern, who very shrewdly saw an opportunity to break into London Northwestern territory. As was not surprising, and echoing Dr Beeching's report a century later, the small branch line was a financial flop, with low traffic levels exacerbated by 50% of profits going to the Great Northern for operating the line. In 1866, the Great Northern contacted the directors, offering to buy the line, but the shareholders refused. The opening of the Midland Main Line, mere yards from their own, was the death knell for the company, and all but bankrupted, it requested a takeover in 1883. The ultimate result, therefore, was the Great Northern got the branch they wanted, but costing them around £30,000 less than it took to construct in the first place. So the region's railways kept on expanding and developing throughout the period, following national trends. But what were the railways' broader impacts? In the era known as the railway age, it's claimed people increasingly have a capacity to be mobile, whether short journeys for work or leisure, or more permanent migration. The rise of great industrial areas equally has been credited with drawing people away from the countryside, looking for urban employment. To understand how population changed across this region, census summary tables outlining village populations were accessed via the National Archives. The cadal percentage change per parish was calculated, banded, and mapped. The aim was simple: to find any correlations between changes in parish levels and proximity to railway lines. The data revealed essentially three broad stages of development and several interesting trends. Prior to the railways, several parishes had marked decline next to others with sharp growth, indicating short-distance migration between parishes. While there were some exceptional cases of this post-railways, this generally diminished during the railway age. In the early years of railway development, there was no immediate correlation between it and population. As with the canals and turnpikes beforehand, their terminus-to-terminus operation had, for the most part, only a minor local effect. Once the railways were properly established, though, they began to increasingly correlate, with virtually all markedly growing parishes being on or by railway lines. While the parishes and counties vary considerably in many ways, their overall effects and changes ultimately consisted of just three actual trends. Few at first, but growing throughout the period, distinct corridors of population growth following railway lines became present. Significantly, they had no other correlation with their immediate surroundings, population growth following lines even when passing through large areas of active decline. While this continued in the more urban south throughout, in the north, especially Buckinghamshire, from 1851 it began to have rising levels of decline with almost no regard for the position of the railways. This indicates that contrary to the earlier case of railways being a factor in population growth, they began actively helping draw off people from these particularly rural areas. This negative rural railway impact correlates directly with the broader premise of rural to urban migration following the Industrial Revolution. Connected to this trend, not only did railways have some impact on their immediate vicinity, as per these corridors of growth, but by the last decades, when near fully formed, it was apparent that the wider area was being impacted. Parishes the farthest away from railways demonstrated the highest levels of decline, with increasing stability with nearing proximity to lines. Finally, with a few early exceptions, every decade after the first railways had almost every substantially growing parish on or neighbouring a railway. With the first vestiges of London commuting and suburbia by the end of the period, actively countering the national decline, a clear correlation between railways and urbanising settlements was obvious. The existence of virtually all of them pre-railway, though, shows the railways did not impact initial urban population growth. Rather, the already growing towns attracted the railways. But by the later period, when established, the railways did appear to assist, helping keep urban populations stable and growing throughout the wider decline, with London influence itself helped by the railway. West Hertfordshire, as the most urbanised, rose against ever-dwindling levels of rural growth. Bedfordshire was primarily rural and suffered much greater decline, Luton and Bedford its only urbanised parishes. In a much more localised way, these acted akin to London, supporting and influencing their immediate vicinity. Excepting the main town of Slough, in the still rising south nearer London, Buckinghamshire was the most rural. Originating in the most rural north of this county, the aforementioned growth corridors became less defined, and with none of the attractions of urban areas, the falling population percentages indicate railway presence was a factor in active decline rather than growth. One aspect to briefly mention. While there was a declining national population average by 1901, West Hertfordshire and some parts of South Buckinghamshire had growing population, particularly unusual for a rural area at this time. These late sudden rises are attributable to a new phenomenon, especially in the vicinity of London, commuting. With people actively moving to well-connected areas in order to commute daily into work, railways were a vital factor, both in this period and after. These general trends must all work together to create an urban-rural divide, and through London and the southerly placement of most urban areas, a north-to-south divide. While the railways were a factor in this, this also affected the railways, with a greater concentration of lines nearer London. Therefore, while railways did not actively cause the rise of most towns, they did help maintain them during times of decline, whereas in rural areas, especially during these declines, they assisted with leeching people away, so worsening the issue. Now, railways have always been associated with urbanisation. A difficult thing to identify, urbanisation has most often been equated with occupation. Put quite simply, some sectors are considered more rural than others. So identifying the numbers employed in agriculture versus, for example, professional jobs, such as solicitors or clerks, can indicate how an area has developed over time. While genealogists used person-by-person census records, post-1841, collated tables were amassed for statistical reports. Detailing the total employed per job type for each county, these tables were modified by grouping into individual sectors. Percentages of the total employed per sector were calculated, creating basic county-wide overviews of their development. Considering 1851 to 1901, some sectors diminished in preference of others, ever increasingly by the end of the period. The rising sectors, notably manufacture, building, transport, professional occupations and retail, were all initially minor and would likely have only been required in greater numbers with the onset of urbanisation. Decreasing agricultural levels further support this, also demonstrating the national agricultural decline of the 1870s. However, despite all factors working towards urbanisation, the region remained substantially agrarian, again with most sectors remaining relatively stable. So while some sectors overtook others in extent, and all were expanding to varying degrees, on the immediate surface, the railways had no dramatic effect. There was no point when a line opened and the entire occupational structure transformed, no direct change as it were. Instead, it's far more likely that railways had a much wider general economic stimulus. Even if just through facilitating worker mobility or moving goods, the railway still had some impact. But this appears for the most part to have been subtle and across the board. Furthermore, with earlier canals and later agricultural decline, railways were unlikely to have started the process either. However, through the benefits railways provided, including population mobility, they were in a position to facilitate the growth of the more urban sectors listed, so indirectly aiding the development of a more sophisticated rural-urban occupational structure. Interestingly, there was evidence of sharper growth occurring across several sectors, circa 1881 to 1901, at a point when railway competition in terms of service and price was at its zenith. This was the era of the two great Race to the North speed competitions. Under the auspices of engineers such as Johnson, Ivatt and Webb, the locomotive itself had developed greatly in terms of speed and haulage power from even only the 1850s, while governmental insistence on continuous brakes and the absolute block enabled greater safety at these speeds. Blueprints and Board of Trade papers, amongst many others at the National Railway Museum and National Archives, give intricate details of this time of rail advancement. Therefore, with the railways in a time of renewed improvement and needing to compete through service as much as line construction, it would be surprising for this not to have been a factor in aiding employment sectors to expand faster and thus quickening the rate of economic development on a general level. While railways had these general effects, they could also simultaneously have more specific involvement, especially with industry and commerce. So what about specific sectors? Agriculture had already ceased expanding before the railways and was actively declining well after they were established. While railways had little direct correlation, there being no major changes in type of agricultural employment, in providing rapid transit of perishable foodstuffs, opening up distant markets, and enabling superior communication of improved or mechanised ways of agriculture, railways had some effect. The occupational decline in itself addresses the decreasing population growth in heavily rural areas as they moved away to find employment, traditionally to urban areas. But the evidence suggests that at best, railways were only a minor factor in a decline that was already well underway. Miscellaneous manufacture, by comparison, had much greater correlation, though not always beneficial. Since circa 1560, Long Crendon in Buckinghamshire manufactured needles, but mechanisation in Birmingham caused the industry to die out as workers migrated. There was a revival in 1848, but inadequate rail links to the centre of the county at that time proved fatal. Although the Wickham Railway to Tame opened soon after, the industry never returned. At the other extreme, Hertfordshire's printing and papermaking grew markedly and became well known. And although John Dickinson and Company primarily retained canal transport, the railways were increasingly used, not just for transporting heavy raw materials, but also enabling communication links to publishers in London. More broadly, the railways themselves increased demand for tickets, timetables and other printed material. Furthermore, improved communications due to railways generally led to rising circulation of newspapers and facilitated the penny post, while platform bookstalls coupled with heightened literacy led to greater demand for books, all creating a boom time for printers and papermakers, including those in this region. With railways affecting urban expansion, the increase in building trades was especially significant. This was not just in terms of growing isolated or self-sufficient urban areas, but increasingly included commuter suburbs, resulting from both London proximity and rail access directly. The figures suggest Hertfordshire took a slight lead in this sector before being caught up by Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire. These differing growth surges all occurred following the respective peak of each county's rail development. Particularly as construction was obviously not limited to railway infrastructure, but included concentrations of new housing and businesses around them, railways can, unusually, be generally credited with some direct knock-on impact, being a notable cause of this change, unlike with other sectors where local factors played a much greater role. The metalworking sector was capable of being as rural as it could be urban, depending on job types. While for the most part, the main body of those employed in the sector were blacksmiths, by 1861, Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire had a distinct rise in other metalworking jobs of a more engineering nature, notably in mechanics, toolmakers, founders and boilermakers. These types increased particularly around 1891 to 1901, the greatest being in Bedfordshire. Although not directly related to the railways themselves, the rise of hatting was followed by increasing industrial works in Luton, which would have used these trades, partially resulting from the 1889 New Industries Committee. These types of industry needed rail access to transport raw materials and finished goods, demonstrated by their proximity to stations, along with cases of physical connection via sidings. While these sectors were growing, agriculture was not the sole decline. The rural-based woodworking sector in Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire dropped by almost half post-1861, while Buckinghamshire's percentage increased throughout. There's no obvious reason for the former, aside from simply being overtaken by newer crafts, as many woodworking jobs were increasing in physical number. As for Buckinghamshire, some stability came from High Wycombe's chair-making industry. Ironically, they refused to use railways to transport their goods, preferring roads, and around the 1870s began declining, quite likely due to the resultant self-imposed market limitations for avoiding railways. There was another large reason, centering on the town of Wolverton, but as this is an unusual exception, I shall cover it shortly. Food and drink has always had a role in transportation, such as the eponymous station refreshment room, immortalised by Dickens in Mugby Junction. However, one specific Hertfordshire aspect requires particular detail: malting. One of the oldest industries and initially in high demand, it was credited as a factor in establishing the first turnpike roads. After the 1850s, it began to actively decline, despite railways dropping costs and allowing wider distribution. As with other market examples, brewers now had access to wider supplies, and although the Great Eastern Railway carried increasing amounts, the majority was coming from East Anglia. So this side of the beer industry was hindered, while the brewing side actively benefited. Looking at general food-based jobs, there's little surprise that the main body of employment was as much food retail as it was food production. Indeed, in the case of grocers, the census makes particular reference to the provision of imported tea, coffee and chocolate. That Hertfordshire's percentage of food-based jobs quickly rose to be predominant is again unsurprising, considering the rise of commuterism in the county, whereby such food retail would be especially necessary. In terms of wider retail, the data indicates this sector did not rise in significance as much as would be expected. Hertfordshire quickly became the largest, and while the aforementioned reasoning of having much of its system finished still holds, it should be said that Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire's main urban centres did have lines by this point. However, when including innkeepers and grocers, retail gained some significance amongst the sectors, albeit with an important caveat. Historically, as people were increasingly able to travel to more important centres for shops and markets, railways could lead to small markets collapsing. The comparative positioning of failed markets in the region supports this view. To give an example, the 1862 Watford to Rickmansworth branch line gave easy access to a much wider range of shops and a larger market than before. Therefore, fewer would have attended the Rickmansworth market, which failed. The retail trade thus polarised to more urban areas at the cost of particularly rural settlements, and the overall percentage of such retailers was lowered. In being able to bring in perishables and goods from far afield, the railways played a role in both general and food retail. But as this market example shows, arguably railways were just as significant in bringing in people. In this way, they impacted strongly on the success or failure of markets and provincial town commerce. Most importantly, these less than expected retail levels demonstrate that while the region was indeed urbanising, it was still primarily rural and in no way fully urban. The rise of professional occupations, clerks, surgeons, bankers and such like, is the closest associated with this urban development, and the percentages show variation between the counties in the degree to which this was happening. Significantly, if not surprisingly, this sector mirrors the trend shown under the building sector of growth coinciding with rail construction, with Hertfordshire leading. Now, the biggest single source of employment in the region after agriculture was straw work. All three counties rose to make this the most important industry in the region, even if the rise of Chinese and Japanese plat imports in the late 1870s forced a wide-scale employment changeover from plats to hats as the former collapsed. Hertfordshire had some hat and bonnet making, mostly around St Albans, but prior to the market's collapse was mainly concerned with plat. Buckinghamshire retained plat as its primary straw work even after the other counties turned to hatting, and suffered substantially worse through this. Bedfordshire, though, was the main centre for the industry, especially Luton, and much of Buckinghamshire and Hertfordshire's plat served Bedfordshire's hat factories. Therefore, Bedfordshire, and to a lesser extent Hertfordshire, not just made plat, but also had employment utilising it. So while the sector as a whole diminished with the end of locally produced plat, this alternate employment prevented the total failure of the sector, unlike in Buckinghamshire. Significantly, while the rise and fall of the industry does not directly parallel each year of railway development, some important correlations are present. The increase in Bedfordshire's plat employment by 1861 occurred less than a year after the completion of the Great Northern branch line between Luton, Dunstable and Welland Junction, offering Luton access to two main lines to London and the north. The increased market accessibility railways gave and the associated demand for plat would have led to increased production, not just around Luton, but the three counties as a whole. Interestingly, the completion of the Midland Main Line directly through Luton in 1868 did not tally with any large increase in straw, but more pertinently, did not trigger the collapse of the industry either. This occurred 13 years later, well after Bedfordshire had the last of its lines completed. Following the Napoleonic Wars, high tariffs were originally placed on straw imports to protect home industry. In 1871, it was theorised that the new railways could benefit not just in transporting goods, but should there be a dearth of local straw, it could be easily brought in, opening up the market. The premonition quickly became fact. The 1875 invention of mechanised stitching massively increased output at precisely the point when the tariffs were abolished. Local platters were failing to keep up with demand, so businesses turned to imports and local production was wrecked. Therefore, the end of restricted tariffs was a far greater issue than early transport limitations. But with railway infrastructure in place, once the tariffs were dropped, it was capable of more rapidly bringing in overseas raw materials, so undercutting that produced locally quicker than possible without rail. The popularity and fashionable status of Luton's hats encouraged demand, and railways enabled their wider distribution, so aiding this expansion. This is emphatically demonstrated, along with the continued use of the Great Northern for it, by the provision at the end of the period of special trains for hats, and even the construction of vans solely for hat transport. Its popularity directly led to demand outweighing home plat production, so railways played a cyclical support role, with finished hat export fueling rail imports to meet demand, and so on. Of course, technically, there was one final occupation sector affected, transport itself. Unsurprisingly, the rise of the railways triggered a fall in stagecoaches and, more slowly, canals. But when analysing job numbers throughout the period, overall, the railways were just as quickly re-eclipsed by road-based jobs. The reason is simple. Stations often being some distance outside the settlements they served. Short-distance travel, such as the omnibus, rose in order to service them, replacing the erstwhile long-distance stagecoaches. To summarise occupations, most were reasonably stable, and although the area was distinctly rural and relied primarily on agriculture, this diminished to a considerable extent by the end of the period. The railways played a varying role, and while some sectors had more direct effects than the others, the railways were mostly not an overwhelming cause of change. Sometimes they were a key factor, mostly with small industry and building construction, through their ability to cheaply transport goods to and from far afield. But even with these, there were other significant factors not relating to the railways. Railways were mainly of a supporting nature, triggering knock-on effects. The rise of urban occupations over rural, especially agriculture, supports the claim that certain areas saw increased urbanisation in the period. The inclusion of the transport sector in this implies some cyclical action. Improved transport aided urbanisation, which in turn led to further transport improvements. The professional sector, in conjunction with the building sector, furthermore indicates the rise of commuterism, again, railways being a major factor alongside London's proximity. The word potential is vital, however. Railways could indeed facilitate these patterns of effects, but could also lead to the opposite. The provision of a railway did not guarantee the occurrence of any of this, as other factors played a direct role. The distribution of markets clearly demonstrates this. The failing ones could equally have been without or with rail access. Railways undeniably played some role in occupational development, both positive and negative, but for the most part did not initiate occupational change on their own. While they gave some overall stimulus and occasionally had greater specific involvement, for the most part their effects were very subtle and general. The final research aspect is land use. As shown, agriculture has always been paramount. But in terms of the railways, there unsurprisingly was no mass impact on the types and locations of farming, topography and soil naturally being far more significant. Conversely, railways gained revenue from the region's agriculture, equally opening wider markets to them. Agriculture thus appears to have been more beneficial to the railways as a source of revenue than railways were as a factor on the form of agriculture. The only case where railways may well have actively affected type of agriculture were market gardens, a feature most dominant in counties around London. While only just beginning in the period, the ability to send fresh produce to London and distant markets quickly by rail undoubtedly had some impact, and understandably the majority were to be found near railway lines. Considering Potton in Bedfordshire, the privately owned Sandy and Potton Railway was specifically constructed to transport produce from Captain Peel's estate to Sandy to be taken to London markets. Unusually for a small branch line with few passengers, it actually made a profit, and later was absorbed into the Oxford-Cambridge main line. Its first locomotive, Shannon, survives as part of the National Railway Museum's collection, currently in Didcot. Furthermore, in a time of agricultural decline, these rail-based market gardens offered valuable employment, so encouraging a degree of inward migration. These present but one example of a cross-linking, whereby railways, occupations and land use each interacted with each other to cause a greater overall change. An associated factor highly important to early railway development in particular is land ownership. For this, a simplified indication of open and closed parishes was constructed. Closed parishes had land owned by a minority, or even just a single landowner, who could control developments, such as blocking potential early railways, while open parishes conversely had land owned by many, thus limiting this controlling effect. Lines up to 1851 were particularly dependent on landowner approval, especially as many were cautious about the new technology and its impact on land values. While some had little option but to traverse closed parishes, there were many cases found of deviation that clearly involved going around these parishes as much as possible. Of course, there are exceptions. Topography in some instances, such as through the Chiltern Hills, and deviations, such as north of Watford, around the estates of the Earls of Essex and Clarendon, even though the parish itself was open. But by 1900, a very different image was apparent, as lines stopped correlating with these closed parishes. With the rise of the mania periods, much of the population turned to being very pro-rail. Some of the landowning families who originally were against the railways even went on to defend them. Secondly, by the end of the period, many of the proposed lines gained legal powers not previously available. Heavily criticised by some, but seen as a public benefit by others, compulsory purchase powers enabled companies to force the sale of land, so negating the earlier importance of open or closed parishes. As an example of its significance and criticism, John Tenniel's 1868 Punch caricature, The Modern Dick Turpin, or Highwayman and Railwayman, shows the ghost of Turpin approaching a railway director astride a locomotive called Black Bess. They exchange words. Ghost of Turpin. Ho ho, Mr. Director, doing a bit in my line, eh? Railway director. Your line? Ha ha, you were hanged. We rob by Act of Parliament. So while the earliest lines were often blocked by wealthy landowners, these objections later subsided with changing opinions and legal powers. Identifying which parishes had failed or declining markets and which had formerly been coaching stops, comparison with railway routes shows correlations, particularly concerning long-distance road transport. Every one of these economically weakened parishes was either neighboured or traversed by a railway. This shows the effects of railways undermining stagecoaches, but also supports the earlier view of negative railway impacts on smaller provincial markets. As many of the more rapidly growing urban parishes were on or by junctions and hubs, the number of railway connections, as in route options, needs to be considered in greater detail. Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire had 12 hubs each, Bedfordshire 5. Comparing these to the list of major growing areas in 1851 to 1901, the difference between mainline and rural branch line becomes plain. Excepting Buckingham, one of the smallest of the main growths, and Barnet with its London ties, all had hubs, but this accounted for only 8. The other hubs were without major population change. But these were all essentially rural stops, or connections to rural branch lines. These were much more limited in what effects they might have, both by their design and by their necessarily rural positioning. The correlation means the connection between major urban area and major junction location was actually reasonably close, though junctions more likely resulted from wishing to gain business from the rising town rather than initiating the expansion in the first place. After being built, however, they would likely have assisted with the stabilisation of the towns during the later decline. As urban settlements, industry and railways clearly have a link, a broad overview of non-agricultural work in parishes was plotted. In other words, industry. Comparing the data to the railway circa 1900, every hub contained some industry. Furthermore, the vast majority of the semi-industrial parishes lay either on or adjoining railway lines. The areas farthest from them were almost purely agricultural. It should be noted that while some earlier industries naturally lay on canals, most industry identified did not correlate with any waterway. Railways thus appear more of a developmental factor overall than other transport types. Even so, railways did not automatically lead to industrialisation throughout. Therefore, considering the decline in agricultural employment, the likely scenario is that the railways did not initiate industry in these areas, instead being drawn to what was already there, previously founded industry being a substantial reason for the attraction. But once in place, and especially with the decline of terminus-to-terminus trade, it assisted to varying extents, the railways by then attracting industry as it provided import and export potential for goods, materials and workers. The overall patterns demonstrate that hubs were very significant to the railways, to the settlements themselves and to industry in general. To summarise land use, the region was primarily agricultural. The majority of towns were located in the south, with most in Hertfordshire. Buckinghamshire, conversely, had the sparsest urban settlements, with neither London influence nor major hubs to encourage urbanisation. While the railways appear to have had no wide impact on agriculture, there were some localised exceptions, notably with the rise of market gardens. Land ownership showed a correlation with railway routes, as the companies were initially dependent on goodwill to purchase land, though with the introduction of compulsory purchase powers, this connection diminished. The main urban areas were in existence before the railways, attracting them rather than vice versa. This is emphasised by cases of stagnating rural junctions. Similarly, several coaching places with markets demonstrated decline after the collapse of stagecoaching. The majority of industry, although still relatively small scale, was centred upon towns and was present before the railways, quite likely a major factor in attracting hubs to these urban settlements. But, following national trends, expansion of non-agricultural work followed railway lines, parishes farthest away being near purely agricultural. Therefore, overall, railways facilitated some land use changes in some parishes, but did not cause mass change across the region. Similarly, the railways did not directly cause urbanisation or initiate industrialisation itself, nor were urban areas dependent on them for initial growth. But once drawn to and servicing these, the railways distinctly had some effect, with industry ultimately concentrating upon this important resource. Railways thus did affect urban development and industry, but more as a result of other formative factors than being in itself the initiator. There is, of course, always an exception to the rule, though, and while railways were shown to be but one factor in many, for the town of Wolverton in Buckinghamshire, this is simply wrong. In the 1820s, the hamlet, now known as Old Wolverton, was a minuscule collection of farms. By 1901, the empty fields had become a complete town, one of the largest in Buckinghamshire, and it owed all this to a locomotive tender. The Furness Railway locomotive copper knob in the National Railway Museum's collection has nothing to do with this area. But its design, notably its tender, was identical to those used on the London-Birmingham Railway. It could hold sufficient coke and water to propel a train for 64 miles. The railway's length was 112 miles. Therefore, the main works had to be in the centre, Wolverton. Every last aspect economically and socially in the entire history of the town centres on this single calculation. As the world's first planned railway town, it was the blueprint for all others, and its fame ever increased. Amongst its achievements were the McConnell Bloomer Express locomotives, and once converted to carriage production, it has even been claimed the gas pilot light was invented here. But most important were the fleets of royal trains built and maintained there, right up to the present day. Indeed, Queen Victoria's Saloon here at the Railway Museum is considered the finest workmanship ever to leave their shops. Considering population first, the census clearly shows this parish had the largest percentage growth. Logical, as the initial population jumped from 417 in 1831 to 1,261 by 1841 and kept growing. The railway was the primary cause, most being their employees. Turning to occupation, Wolverton was a one-industry town. Workers were trained in metalwork, and after the 1864 transfer to carriage production, in wood, upholstery and such like. But excluding the limited number of jobs in the refreshment room made famous by Sir Francis Head, there were few jobs for the wives and daughters. The railway's chairman, Richard Moon, therefore offered some land to McCorkdale printers. So even the non-railway work was directly initiated by the railway. Finally, land use. The town developed based on the needs of the railway it served. Originally, only houses sufficient for the number of workers were built. But as more engines and later carriages were needed, the works expanded regularly and new workers needed new housing. In addition, churches, schools, a science and art institute, public baths, pubs and shops were built. Everything needed was financed by the company, as recorded at the minutes held at the National Archives. Wolverton was the very opposite of the average settlement, owing everything directly to the whims of the railway and being originally, at least, utterly dependent on it. Plainly, it was an important exception and shows the great variety of effects railways could have from parish to parish. Much more could be said, but greater details on railway towns are to be presented by Dr. Drummond in her presentation on Wolverton's greatest rival, Crewe. To draw some conclusions, much of the research kept pulling aspects together, suggesting a collective connection between mobility, industry, urbanisation and transport. When industrialising occupations, increasing population and improved communications through transport came together, urbanisation was the result. For the most part, the beginning of this predated the railways. However, once started, it was the railways that enabled the process to quicken. Once urbanisation had begun, each factor began to interweave with each other. Urbanisation and easy rail access led to population growth. Good railways and rising population attracted industry. Growing population and industrial business attracted improved railway infrastructure. Industry and developing transport fostered urbanisation, and so on. By the same token, improved communication led to agricultural advancement, so requiring fewer people. It opened wider markets, not just bringing goods in, but people farther out. Railways became an emigration route. Just as they could bring benefits to a progressive location, so too could they bring an entrenched way of life to its knees. It cannot be said that railways were the sum cause of change. There were other factors, and their extent varied from one location to another. However, railways should not be underplayed. Some aspects they did directly affect. Newspapers, the Royal Mail, even time itself. While they may not have been central, railway facilitation of other factors created chains of consequences, which without that link, at best, would have been much slower, and at worst, may not have happened. It's clear why past studies concentrated on urban-heavy industry. This is where railways have the greatest impact. In rural areas, much of their main effect was in a similar manner, albeit at a much smaller scale. Railways were also proven to be a double-edged sword, and was distinct and negative for the most rural of areas, as they were a benefit for those moving away from their rurality. Although not as clear-cut as once thought, railways were very important. Wherever you were, with or without a direct connection, railways changed lives. To quote George Carglin, 1st Baronet of Wolverton and Chairman of the London North Western Railway, "I hope it will not be forgotten that it is due to the railway interest that this great social improvement and boon of modern times has been carried out."
This talk was recorded on the 14th of September 2013 at the National Railway Museum, York. The podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.